Recorded live right here in Little Rock, Arkansas, is Larry's Rants, Raves, and Reviews. And now, here is Larry.
Hey, everybody. Happy New Year.
Yeah.
Happy New Year, guys.
That's the same crowd that...
I'm telling you, they show up every time. And
I think so.
They're going to hang in there for the next year with us, I promise you. They're going to be here. Folks, we are excited once again, and we're coming to you on New Year's Day, and we are just thrilled about our show. We've got something that we're going to talk to Richard Yotta, a very good friend of mine. I actually had the privilege of working with Richard about 4 or 5 years, and honestly, Randy, he's one of the most pleasant guys that you'll ever be around.
Oh, yeah, I've talked to him a little bit.
I mean, I just like Richard, and he's so even-keeled. I've never seen him mad. I've never seen him really angry. I just, you know, he's just an even-keeled kind of guy. You know, I'm all over the map, but Richard,
right.
He's just right there, you know.
Right.
And so anyway, we've got a good show, and folks, we're gonna have Richard tell his story. And, you know, after him telling this story, I think that you may sit back and look at the fact that Cheryl, my sister, used to say, you know, Larry, you can become bitter or you can become better.
Right.
And after hearing his story, I think people are going to realize that Richard became better, and it's by his choice, and he could have gone either direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, folks, back, we're going to talk about Pearl Harbor, the attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. President Franklin D. Roosevelt said that this is a date that will live in infamy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Richard is he's really a hero, a fighter pilot, he flew in 59 combat missions and has a wonderful story. So to keep me from just babbling on, Richard, I'm going to throw it to you. Start your story. We'll jump in with comments and questions. And just, I've heard this story before.
Have you?
Live
I
in a speech. Oh, you hang on, buddy, for the ride, because it's good. Talk to us, Richard.
Well, thank you, Larry, and Happy New Year to everybody.
Thank you.
And to you. I want to, let's start from the very beginning of how we got here.
Okay.
My father's parents were in from Hiroshima, Japan, and they immigrated to Hawaii, legally immigrated to Hawaii in the 1890s.
Okay.
And my dad was born in Hawaii in 1905. And my mother's parents were immigrant farmers from Japan. They just came over to during the busy season to help with the harvest of the crops, and they were here for some time, but when the kids got school age, they sent all the kids back to Japan to live with an aunt, because as they were moving around all over the state, they weren't getting a good education, so they sent them back to Japan for their education. And before the war started, the parents moved back to Japan, and kids were getting ready to graduate, so they came back to California, where they were born. So to state that they were born, my parents were born as American citizens. So,
yes.
Father in Hawaii, being U.S. territory at the time, and my mother was born in California. So my father grew up in Hawaii. His parents immigrated to Hawaii as the sugar plantations were looking for workers and were having a hard time. So they went to Japan and had a lot of people come over from Japan to work in the sugarcane fields. But, you know, after they got there, they basically become indentured servants, because even if they didn't like it, they couldn't get back to Japan if they wanted to. So they were pretty much stuck there, and just a step above slave labor, I guess.
But, okay.
My father, he went through the eighth grade, and he quit school to help the family he worked in the sugarcane fields to help the family with their income. And my mother, again, being educated in Japan, she came back to California back in 1930s. And my father, as he was working in Hawaii, he could tell that he didn't want to make a living working in the sugarcane field all his life. So he asked his mother if he could go to the mainland, being California. But his mother wanted him to stay in Hawaii to help the family with their income. But eventually, his sisters talked his mother into letting him go to California. To learn, being an auto mechanic. And so he lived with a family as their houseboy, I guess, and went to school, learning the auto mechanic trade whenever he could. So he grew up a lot on, he said, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. So so he had a lot of that. So, but anyway, As he grew older, he went into farming, and when Pearl Harbor occurred, he was running. He had a farm with about 15 to 20 employees working, helping him on the farm, and he bought new tractors and trucks and equipment. And then when Pearl Harbor hit, they had about 3 weeks to get rid of everything they owned and report to an assembly center.
Now, wasn't this around San Diego?
It was around Stockton, California.
Oh, okay.
In San Joaquin Valley.
Okay.
And they were told to get rid of everything they had and bring only what they could carry to an assembly center. And in the meantime, they were building the 10 relocation camps around the country, two of them being in Arkansas, and the other eight on them. Two in California, and then Arizona, Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming. Not the most pleasant places in the world, but the two in Arkansas, no one really knows why they chose Arkansas.
Okay. But they chose these different locations because they moved everybody to the interior of the United States, off of the coast, correct?
Yes. All the Japanese in California, Washington, and Oregon, and a little part of Arizona were being sent to a relocation camp.
And that's about 120,000 people. Give or take,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, roughly, yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. 10 different camps that we put
10
together.
10 camps and two in Arkansas.
And these are homeowners, these are citizens, these are people that are just enjoying life. And,
oh, yeah, they're doctors, college professors, kids going to college, and they had to quit school. Doctors, they were just displaced. Even, you know, they even took orphans in orphanages and took them out of the orphanage, put them in the camps.
Now the one in Arkansas, was that in Fort Smith?
No, the two in Arkansas were in southeast Arkansas, around McGee. There's one about 10 miles north of McGee, and another about 10 miles south of McGee.
Oh, okay.
And each of them held 8,000, roughly 8,500 people.
And that was called what is it? Rower?
Rower and Jerome.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
And they were probably close to the fourth and fifth largest cities in the state of Arkansas at the time in 1943.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Really? Wow.
You wouldn't think it today.
Yeah. How they pull that off, I don't know. But anyway, during that time, when Pearl Harbor hit, of course, everything went into chaos. The Japanese kids who were of age immediately went to the enlistment center. They wanted to join the U.S. military to fight the Japanese army, military. So they went up to the enlistment center, and they were told that they could not enlist. And furthermore, they were declared enemy aliens and were not allowed to enlist. So they went home. They were disappointed. Well, they were really upset and mad, but there was nothing you could do. In Hawaii, they tried to make a internment camp outside of Honolulu. But then they found out that 49 or 50% of their workforce in Hawaii were Japanese, and their economy would come to a halt. So they disbanded that camp, said that's not a good idea. That's why Hawaii started a camp, but then it was disbanded. In California, they gave everybody anywhere from 1 week to 3 weeks to get rid of everything and report to the camp, which caused them to have basically a fire sale. You know, I've heard people selling their cars for $5 or $10, sell all their furniture for pennies on the dollar, and people would be walking into their house knowing that they were having to leave. They would say, "Hey, I'll give you a dollar for your refrigerator," or something like that. And one gentleman, someone walked up to his house, offered him $5 for his car, and he says, "Wait a minute." So he goes out to his car, pours gasoline on it, and burns it.
Mine.
Said, "I'll be damned if I'll sell the car for $5. So things like that went on, and the FBI were searching all the Japanese houses looking for anything that might think that they might have allegiance to Japan, and being sending information. But my mother got scared. So she grew up or went to school in Japan. She had pictures and all kinds of memorabilia from Japan. So she got scared and said, "Well, they're going to find this and split the family up." So she pretty much burned everything.
Wow.
She had. So we don't have any pictures of her as a child.
Wow.
But she had cameras and stuff. She just had them all burned or threw them in the river. Most of the houses were being searched by the FBI. I mean, it's like someone ransacked your house, without notice.
Wow.
So, now, you weren't born yet.
No, I was not. I was born in the camp.
You were born in the camp.
Yeah, my brother was about 4 years old.
Gotcha.
At that time.
Yeah.
And he had to go through all that. And for the kids in the camp, it was, a pretty good deal. But for my parents and the adults who knew what was happening, it had to be pretty traumatic experience.
I know.
For them.
I know when that happened. I don't know. But my dad, I remember stories. My dad, he would tell me when he was a boy, I think he was about 5 or 6 or 7. Mm-hmm. No, probably, I don't know, 10 or something. Mm-hmm. But he was at the movie theater downtown Little Rock. And they stopped the movie. And they said, "Everybody needs to go home because Pearl Harbor has just been bombed."
Wow.
And so, he didn't know what Pearl Harbor was. And so
sure.
He was running home and he was looking up in the sky and he thought the airplanes were coming over here.
Okay.
So he was, I remember him telling me, he was running home looking up in the air and making sure that nothing was around here,
Yeah.
But that's what he experienced when he was a little boy at that time.
Well, it certainly took our country and put it into a tailspin.
Oh, yeah. Well, I remember I was visiting with Senator Daniel Inouye, who was a senator from Hawaii, and just probably 20 years ago. And he said, he was in the National Guard at the time. And then he said, it was a Sunday morning, and he heard the explosions, and he looked out, went outside and saw the Japanese airplanes with the red dot on the planes, and he said to himself, with this happening, the world of the life as I know it now will be changing. That's what he experienced that, and then he being in the National Guard, he was sent to Camp Shelby. They were first they wouldn't take new enlistments from Japanese, but the ones that were already in, they sent them to a training camp in I think it was Shelby, Mississippi. Camp Shelby, Mississippi.
Okay.
And they were trained there, and there were two units. There were the Hawaiian Japanese, who were the 100th Battalion, and the 442nd was the Japanese who were like in the National Guard or already enlisted in the Army. They got to stay in, but they formed a segregated unit, a military unit of all Japanese troops, training them in Camp Shelby, and then there was a military intelligence service for those who could speak Japanese fluently. Were sent to, I think it was Minnesota, to learn how to speak the Japanese language a little better and what the new dialects were. And they were sent, they were put behind enemy lines in the Pacific. The 442nd and 100th were sent to the European theater in Germany and Italy and France. But prior to that, they was like Senator Inouye was saying that they put the 442nd and 100th, the mainlanders and Hawaiians, together. At first, they couldn't, said they couldn't get along. They were always fighting, the Hawaiians against the mainlanders.
Okay.
And Army couldn't figure it out. And so they sent, Senator Inouye said they sent a bunch of the Hawaiian troops to Rohr and McGee. To U.S., there was a USO unit there that entertained the troops. So they were, a bunch of them were sent to Rohr and McGee, I mean Rohr and Jerome, to visit. And the senator, anyway, said he didn't know of Jerome or Rohr. And when they drove up in their military trucks, said, "Well, I guess we're coming to the a military base around here that we didn't know about, because there were barracks and all surrounded by fence and armed guards." And so they let them in, and they soon found out that there were families like his family that were just basically in prison.
Yeah.
And they didn't know that. The Hawaiians didn't know that, and they spent the night there and went to dance and visited with the family, stayed with the families, and a lot of the families allowed them to stay in their barracks or their living unit. But they said, no, they didn't want to take a space. So they put sleeping bags in not the restaurant, but the mess hall where everybody ate. And then when they went back to Camp Shelby, the Hawaiians talked to the other Hawaiians that didn't go, and they told them what the mainlanders' families were going through. And Senator Inouye says, at that point, we became a unit. Said we had to show that we were loyal Americans, and that if we were show that the Japanese forces were loyal, and by doing what they're supposed to do, maybe their families would be released earlier.
You know, as I was preparing for this show, obviously I went back and just tried to study some history and pull different articles and everything. And that was one of the things that I was noticing, is that the people that were sent to these camps had to really try hard to prove their loyalty to America. And, you know, just so that they would be treated properly and different things like that. Mm-hmm. Hey, we're coming up on a commercial break. Let's take a commercial break, and then we're going to come back and pick this story right up where we're laying off.
Okay.
Bobby's Country Cooking. It's like Sunday after church at Grandma's, except it's Monday through Friday, 10:30 to 2. Home-style cooking with generous portions, entrees, sides, and desserts to die for. Dine in or get it to go. We're in the West Chase Plaza at the corner of Shackelford and Markham. Bobby's Country Cooking.
All right, folks, we're back. Now we were talking about the internment camps. There's 10 different ones, and please correct me if I'm wrong, okay? But while they were building these camps, it's my understanding that they took a lot of the people and put them into fairgrounds and people like that. They were actually using some of the stalls that were in fairgrounds that livestock would be in and things, and put them in these areas and kind of did makeshift areas for them to live until they could get this housing and these camps actually built. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. They made these little assembly centers, or I guess they were kind of mini camps, while the 10 camps were being built. They had to start right after Pearl Harbor, I guess, or after Executive Order 9066 was signed in February of 42, where they had said that all the Japanese would be rounded up and put into these camps. So that's when they started these buildings. Now,
And for the most part, wasn't the Japanese people treated pretty fair, except for one or two of the camps that people were, as fair as you can, okay, you're being put in camps, so don't get me wrong, okay? Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is there's always the bad apple, okay? Oh, yeah. Out of 10 camps, you're going to have one or two. Wasn't everybody treated pretty decently, except for one or two? I read some history of there were people that were shot that they claimed,
Yeah, there were some incidents like that. I think there were one or two people shot at Roar. I guess they were too close to the fence or something like that, and they were shot. But there was a loyalty oath passed out after about 6 months after the big camps were open. But prior to that, to go back to the assemblies before the camps were built, there were 20 or 25 smaller camps where what you said was they were put into like fairgrounds, like Arkansas State Fairgrounds.
Yeah.
Or Santa Anita Racetrack was the one that they used out in California. But they cleaned the horse stalls and the cow stalls, and everybody says that no matter how much Clorox, Purex, or whatever you use to clean out a stable, that you cannot get rid of the smell of the animals that were in the stalls.
Of course.
And the people were given a cot to sleep on, and they were given these sheets that they could stuff hay into to make their mattresses and pillows. And most of the places after you made your mattress and pillow out of the hay that you stuffed into those material, they found out there were fleas in that hay.
Oh.
So just about all the camps, it was flea infested, and they'd start all over. In addition to having no running water in their room, or had to use community restroom facilities and a community mess hall where you had to wait in line three times a day just to eat. But as far as being fed, they were fed. The temporary housing for about 6 months that people had to live in those. It had to be pretty distraught for most of the people. Now, for the kids, you smell the horse manure and things like that. They said, well, if there's a horse manure around, there's got to be a pony somewhere. So. Well, that never happened, I guess.
Yeah. Never found the pony. Huh?
Never found a pony.
Okay. All right.
But they were there for 6 months and then shipped to the 10 different camps.
Okay.
And how they figured who's going where, nobody knows.
And weren't the camps set up similar to, you see pictures like army barracks, big long?
Yeah, they were 120 foot long.
Yeah.
And they divided those up into six different living units. So they had each family had a room of approximately 20 feet by 20 feet.
Okay.
That's not very big.
No.
That's less than a first down.
Yeah. Yeah. You got kids today that whine if their bedroom isn't that big.
That's right.
So living in different times, aren't we?
Yeah.
But
back then, the most of the, well, I don't think any of the Japanese owned guns, so they couldn't protect themselves. So they were pretty easy to round up. But there's a movie called Snow Falling on the Cedars. I took my mother to see it, and they took these families to report to a bus, I guess, to go to the assembly center. So they walked down the street from their house to where the buses were and trucks, and they could only take what they could carry, so it wasn't very much. But the people lying in the streets, they were yelling at them, cussing at them, spitting at them. And,
What was the name of that movie?
Snow Falling on the Cedars.
Okay.
It was probably back in 1990s.
Yeah.
And folks, we're living in different times. I mean, and I'm not approving of anything. I'm not saying any of that. But 2,400 Americans were killed. Over 1,200 of them were injured, in all of this Pearl Harbor and everything. Caught us completely by surprise. Mm-hmm. And so then this is now happening. Richard, so your family and friends, if you will, were, you know, living in sunny California, just mm-hmm. enjoying the good life, you know, and everything. And then all of a sudden you said they've got 2 to 3 weeks to get rid of everything, mm-hmm. pack up, and whatever they can carry, they get to get on a bus and go to a camp. So are you ready to fast forward and talk about life in that camp? What's some of your first memories inside that camp? You were born in one of the camps,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, I was born in Aurora Camp
in
Southeast Arkansas. For the kids, it was actually pretty good because, you know, you had no chores to do.
Okay.
Had all the kids to play with. For the parents, it was kind of traumatic in that, they were uprooted, had to give up everything. And the government, they had jobs to do, like cooks, and they had to have each room that we talked about earlier were 20 by 20, but the only thing in there was the cots that they gave for each family member and a potbelly stove and one light bulb hanging from the ceiling. There's no running water, no restroom. You had to go to the restroom in the middle of the night. You had to get out of the house and go to a building somewhere in the vicinity.
Yeah, right.
But the parents, I guess, had a tough time in that when they went to the mess hall for their meals, of course, the parents weren't. Japanese family, for dinner time, you know, they like to sit around and talk about what you did right that day, what you did wrong, and get lecture number 365, you know, like you give your kids.
Yeah, right, right. Now, you were born in the camp. When were you released from, what age were you released from the camp?
The camps were, most of the camps were closed in 1945.
So what age were you when?
I was 3.
Oh.
So when we left.
Okay. That would have made your brother about 7?
He was 7 or 8, yeah.
Okay, yeah, okay.
Yeah, he was of school age, so
okay.
I was still a toddler.
Okay.
But in the camps, when they had mealtime, the kids, of course, wanted to go sit with their friends, and the parents wanted the kids to sit with them to go over what they did during the day, but the family unit, the structure, started to deteriorate because the kids wanted to go play with the kids and the parents couldn't sit down with the kids and talk to them during mealtime. So that was a big problem that they were having. And then there was that loyalty oath that they passed out in 6 months after the camps were open. And there were two questions in there that really got everybody upset. That one was, will you be something similar to, would you be loyal to the United States no matter whatever happens? Of course, you can answer yes. And then, would you fight for the military, or the U.S. military, if you were asked to do so? And that was another point of contention. And then the other last question, number 28, was, will you forswear allegiance to any foreign country, something similar to that, which meant that the people, the Japanese that were in the camp, 67% of them were United States citizens. The other 33 were immigrants or hadn't applied for citizenship yet. So of those, the 33% were not citizens. If they said they would forswear loyalty to any other foreign country, well, they weren't a citizen of the United States. If they were from Japan and they said they forswear their allegiance to that in Japan, it would be an individual without a country. So they said, well, how do we answer that? And then about the being loyal to the United States and fight wherever they were asked to fight, they said, well, that'd be all right, but we're in prison, so how should we answer that? So if you answered no and no to those two questions, you were considered a troublemaker.
Okay.
And they were sent to a camp in Northern California called Tule Lake. It was a prison inside of a prison. So if you were a troublemaker, you were put into another prison in okay. Tule Lake. So the people who answered no and no to those two questions were sent to Tule Lake. And one of my friends now, an actor named George Takei, he was Mr. Sulu in the original Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah.
He was at the Roar camp, and his parents answered no and no, and they were sent to Tule Lake.
If I'm not mistaken, and I could be, but during my research and reading up on this, that was the camp that you came in by train, and you had like a mile or 2 mile hike to get there, and they had armed guards, obviously, along the trail and walking, and that was the place where some of them were, some of the bad guards, if you will, shot some people in the back swore, yeah, they were trying to escape, and they weren't, all the witnesses. And then I also remember reading about inside the camps that the parents began to set up their own government, if you will, kind of to gain control of what their families. Because, again, these are people that are law-abiding citizens that just got rounded up. And so they're wanting to maintain this level of decency within the camp. And I do remember, Richard, one guy, and I don't know, you can probably speak to this, but maybe not. One guy said, well, they told us that we were going to be put in this camp for our own safety. But why is it a safety that we're behind the fence and the guards' guns are aimed at us, not outside to the enemy?
Exactly. That's what it was. When they got to the camps, there were military police in there were guard towers all along the perimeter of the camp with the machine guns pointed in.
Yeah.
And George K. was telling me he was about 8 or 9 at the time. He said he thought it was pretty cool because we had to go to the bathroom at the middle of the night. The spotlight, since he was moving, they would put a spotlight on him to see where he's going. And he said, oh, that's pretty cool. They're helping me get to the bathroom.
And there were not people that got too close to the fence because there were people obviously shot, all. If you got too close to the fence, they thought you were trying to escape.
Right, right. So, yeah. You know, in Southeast Arkansas at the time, you know, Aurora was just swamp grounds, and, you know, why anybody, if you did escape, they wouldn't know where to go.
Yeah.
They didn't know where they were to begin with.
And, right. Yeah, right.
But anyway, with the camps, they were to be placed in the camp, but prior to that, when the houses were searched, there were, at the time they were sent to the camp, there were no arrests or inquiries about any Japanese trying to prevent sabotage or sending information to Japan or ships or whatever. And There are no trials, no files charge, no arrests, but they're by one signature of the president, and that's when Executive Order 9066 to say that all the Japanese would be sent to a camp. Mm. And this general, John DeWitt, he was a lieutenant general. He was a three-star general. He was the one that was saying that any person with one drop of Japanese blood will be put into camps.
Okay.
And that's how they were sent over there without a trial. And that's, the ACLU was around, but when the ACLU turns back on you, you know you're in trouble.
Well, and because Pearl Harbor happened, correct me if I'm wrong, but it happened because, according to a treaty of war, when a nation was going to declare war on another nation, they were supposed to send an actual declaration of war saying, we're getting ready to go to war with you and attack you. Mm-hmm. But because that was sent, our government did not have, it was sent, but it was supposed to be interpreted early in the morning, and it wasn't until later that night, correct? If I'm not mistaken, well, something like that?
Yeah, I'm not really familiar with that part.
Okay, okay, all right. Well, and that's what I've studied and all. And so all of a sudden, bam, hours before they got it all interpreted, they were beginning to get the hint of, through interpreting this, Japan's getting ready to attack us. They just didn't know when and where. And all of a sudden, it happened. And so we were attacked in Pearl Harbor before we really knew, and it happened like an hour or two after Japan figured, hey, they've already got this thing figured out. Now we're going in for the attack. Mm-hmm. And so it really took us into uncharted water here and again, I'm not trying to justify. Okay, I'm not trying at all. I'm just saying there's different things that happened. And so obviously war is a terrible thing in our history, no matter how you slice it, no matter where mm-hmm. you stand. But we're going to go to a commercial break, but I want to come back because honestly, Richard, I feel like you and your brother and many of your brothers are heroes, if you will. And so I want to go back to, when we come back, I want to talk about your time in the service and how, if I'm not mistaken again, after a couple of years in the internment camps, they started asking for your help and all, because mm-hmm. I thought that that was a very intriguing part of your story. And so we'll be right back and give us a commercial break here, and then we'll come back and we'll start wrapping up, okay?
Okay.
When your event is catered by Bobby's Country Cooking, it's like coming home to eat. And Bobby's makes it easy. 224-9500 for the best home-style catering available with desserts to die for. The food you love for your next gathering. Bobby's Country Cooking, Little Rock.
All right, folks, we're back from commercial. And Richard, I think that there was some type of a draft, if I'm not mistaken, inside the camps that started drafting the Japanese warriors, if you will. And that's where I really want to go to, because I consider you guys some heroes, and I want to hear about this. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Well, remember I mentioned earlier about, when Pearl Harbor occurred, the Japanese men of age went in to enlist.
Yes.
To join the U.S. military. And they were turned away, and declared, enemy aliens. But after about a year, after the war started, we were losing some battles, especially in the Pacific, and they were running short of men. And we had a draft at that point. So they came into the camp. So they figured out that there's some men of age that could help in the military. So they went into the camps and then said that either you could be drafted or you could volunteer to join the military. We'll take you now. So, which really caused a problem in the families. a lot of them are saying, it's okay. A lot of men said, hey, we'll volunteer, but how about letting our families get out of this prison and go back home? And then the other families say, well, why is your son joining the military when we're still in prison and they put us in prison and we can't get out? And now we're going to fight the enemy with our own kids. And so there was a lot of families that were really in arms against each other at that time. But they finally put in the or asked for volunteers. And actually, out of Roar, there was about 800 guys, men that joined the military from wow. just that little camp in Roar, which is, you know, okay. about 10% of the population. And they were all put into the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. It was training at Camp Shelby and sent to the Pacific Theater.
And weren't they, didn't they become like the most decorated?
Yeah, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. They were sent to Europe, mainly Italy, France, Germany, to fight the German army that had pretty much taken over the whole all those countries. And there were several battles. And Senator Inouye said, you know, Richard said, we knew they felt like we were dispensable. So if there was a tough battle that they didn't think we could win, we were sent in.
I remember you saying yeah. something to that effect yeah. when I've listened yeah. to your speech, you know, before, mm-hmm. that you kind of got the worst battles. They sent you in because it's like, well, if we lose them, we lose them.
Yeah, that's pretty much what Senator Inouye was telling me.
Okay.
There's one battle that's Vosges Mountains in the forest in, I think it's France or Germany. But they were like the rescue of the Texas Rangers. There were 178 to 200 Texas Rangers that were surrounded by the German army. And unit after unit went in there, tried to get them out, and they could not do it. They were running out of food, water, ammunition, and about to be overrun. And I don't know, about maybe 3 or 4 months of trying to get them out, or 3 or 4 weeks of trying to get them out. No one get them out. Tried to drop airlift stuff to them, but the enemy got most of it because it rolled downhill. And
okay.
And after a while, after they're about to give up, they called in the 442nd and said, hey, you guys need to go in. Here's the situation. So they went in and they got them out. But the 442nd suffered over 900 casualties to save 178 Texas Rangers.
Wow.
So they were sent in when no one else could.
Right.
And they did a good job. And then there was another one called the Gothic Line between Germany and Italy. For 6 months, the German army had built machine gun nests, and they were entrenched in that mountain. But they had to it covering a trail that they had to go through to get military supplies from Germany to Italy or Italy to Germany, and they could not do it. For 6 months, unit after unit tried to break that line, and they could not do it. So they called in the 442nd, and the 442nd came in, looked at it, and it said, okay, we're going to go in from the back, a big steep cliff in the middle of the night. It said it was so dark it couldn't see your hands in front of your face. So they had to put ropes up and told the guys, we're going up a cliff in the night. If anybody falls, slips and falls, don't yell, because that'll give up our position. So they went up and night, and they got to the top of the mountain from the backside at just about daybreak. And when they see the light of day, they made their move, and I think less than 30 minutes, the Gothic line was broken. The 442nd had went in and took out all the machine gun nests and took out all the machine guns and rifles and anti aircraft artillery, and the line was broken. So then they came down, and again, it was done. It was, they worked on it for 6 months, and these guys did it in less than 30 minutes. When they got through with that, they were sent to Brières, France, where the Nazi army and German army had taken over the whole city, and they'd been there for some time, and they were in houses and people's homes, and using that as a kind of a central staging station. So they sent the 442nd in there. It took them a little while, but they took out they finally took out the German army after about several long battles. And to this day, that city in France, every year they have a parade honoring the 442nd. And even to this day, they do that every summer.
Wow.
A lot of the guys go over there. Of course, they're all pretty much gone now or disabled. But then they were so exhausted after that. That's when they were called to go to the Voyages Mountain to rescue the Texas Rangers. And they were exhausted, but they were marching. And as they were marching, several units just sitting on the side of the road smoking cigarettes and resting. And they were wondering, why aren't they helping? But they went ahead and did their job at the rescue of the Texas Rangers. So that's when Senator Inouye said, we knew they felt like we were dispensable. But after the rescue of the Texas Rangers had suffered 900 casualties, the general in charge, I forget his name, but he asked everybody to report to the base, and they're going to have a parade honoring all the soldiers, and he wanted everybody there. So the 442nd commander, he only had just a few small group of men to show up for the parade, and the general started chewing him out. He said, "I told you I wanted everybody here." He says, "This is all I got." After the rescue of the Texas Rangers, he didn't have enough men. So
wow.
Those are the things they had to face. And Senator Inouye, one of the battles, his arm was shot off. It took him about 24 hours to get medical help, but that's where he suffered his loss of his arm. But he carried on. So he got a – well, it was – the funny thing, one of the things you look back on is that of all the battles they were in and all the things they did, there's only one Medal of Honor issued during the war to a Japanese soldier. And that unit being the most highly decorated unit in the history of the U.S. military, when Bill Clinton took office in the 1990s, 50 years later, he went back. He had them review the old records and said that something's not right. And they looked back at the old records, and they issued 22 more Congressional Medals of Honor for the guys in the 442nd. But that's where, the old good old boy networks, a lot, all of them deserve a Medal of Honor, no matter what color they were. But, in the military, you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. That kind of stuff goes on. And I'm sure the Japanese were not the most favorable people in the world at that time, so they weren't getting any extra care or someone looking after them, I guess, to recognize their...
Well, and after your families were all released from the camp, I remember reading part of the story about the Arkansas governor. I think his last name was Atkins.
Atkins, yeah. Homer Atkins.
He was part of the KKK,
mm-hmm.
Okay?
Oh, gosh.
And he really did not want any Japanese to settle, and it was really, your family and just a few others that continued to settle or did settle here in Arkansas, correct?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
he made it pretty rough.
Yeah, the before the camps were built, the Homer Atkins told the federal government that you can build the camps here, but once the camps are closed, all the Japanese will have to leave the state. They can't buy land, can't go to school. They just got to leave Arkansas, which most of them did. But I guess there were about maybe 7 to 10 families that stayed in Arkansas. My family being one. They worked on farms at Scott, Arkansas, and there were about 2 or 3 families that worked a farm around where the airport, Little Rock Airport, is right now.
Yeah. And I kind of think, if I remember right, they were sharecroppers, and mm-hmm. I didn't even know, I guess, the real meaning of sharecroppers, okay? Like, okay, here's a tractor, so I guess your family would use it, and then the next family would use it, so you shared different equipment and different things?
Yeah, it was far right? like a farming community.
Yeah.
When they were first thinking about coming to Arkansas, there was a family that said they would take them to farm their land and be sharecroppers. But then the superintendent found out about it and said, you've let the Japanese on here and I'm quitting. So the farmers, you know, the farm owners had to have a superintendent who would run the place. So they backed off. And then this lady named Virginia Brown, who later married an Alexander, she became Virginia Brown Alexander. She said, I'll take them. So she had a lot of land in Scott, Arkansas. So she did all the and the sharecropper, she provided the land, some tractors, a mule, and some fertilizer, I guess, and plants. And the Japanese, the seven families in Scott would harvest, do all the harvesting. And Mrs. Alexander actually went out and did all the marketing. She talked to Safeway and Kroger's. And back then there was a curb market where we had peddlers back then who would load a truck up and go around to different communities and sell their produce.
That was back when you could get good produce, Randy.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. Not like that garbage we got in the stores today.
I know it.
If you've been into a grocery store lately, there's some of it I look at like, nah, I wouldn't carry that out of here for free.
Probably shipped from Guatemala or something.
Now, I think it's somewhat humorous because, you know, ever since I've known you for, I forget how many years, 10, 15 years, you always lived in West Little Rock, but now mm-hmm. you're living back in Scott.
Yeah.
You kind of went full circle, didn't you?
Well, living in Scott, it was quite an experience. You know, back in 1945, when we moved there, the people there were so good. I don't think they listened to the radio or they didn't have TV or they didn't know there was a war, I don't think. And they just invited us to all the community activities, the churches, and parties.
Okay.
And,
yeah.
Like nothing happened. You know, the people that went back to California, they had problems getting jobs, place to live.
Oh, okay.
Some of the friends they had before the war, before mm-hmm. the camps opened, they would see each other coming down the sidewalk and their old friend would cross the street so they wouldn't have to talk to them.
Okay. Think
their houses were shot at if they had one. So I guess my father heard about all that and decided, let's just stay in Arkansas for a while.
But you got out of the camps, okay? Mm-hmm. And your parents, if I'm not mistaken, ended up being pretty successful business people, correct?
Well,
Staying here.
Yeah. Well, they worked hard on farms.
Yeah.
You know, my dad he'd get up 4 o'clock in the morning and at 5 o'clock he'd leave the house. Take the produce that were ordered to the Safeway, Kroger's, and the curb mm-hmm. market, and he'd come back about 9 o'clock, go work, get on the tractor and work the fields, and work till about 10 o'clock at night, and he'd get home, he'd get in just in time to watch the 10 o'clock news, so he could watch the weather, see what the weather was going to be the next day.
And didn't they end up owning some kind of a business that then they had to close because they were putting a new highway in or something?
Well, yeah, he as time went on, as he got older, you know, the farmer got he started growing started a greenhouse.
Okay.
And they started growing these from seed to plants like tomatoes and peppers and vegetables, that, mainly tomatoes, that would get a head start growing, start them in the greenhouse and putting them out in the fields. And they were maybe a foot tall and getting a head start on the growing season.
Okay.
And as he started his greenhouse, other farmers come and say, "Hey, would you plant me some, give me some plants so I get started?" So he did, and it kept getting bigger and bigger. And finally, he said, "Well, this greenhouse bigger business was larger than his farming." So he started a greenhouse business, and that became a pretty large part of his income. Where at, when he retired in late 70s, or late, well, I guess it was about 1984, his greenhouse business was the largest of its kind in the state of Arkansas.
Wow. Wow.
Even Walmart wanted him to produce all their plants, sell them all their plants. And, you know, he said that he's getting close to 80 years old at the time. He says, you know, Walmart would be good, but I'd have to buy new equipment, hire a whole lot of people, and
right.
2 years later, Walmart find a better deal, and here I'm stuck with all this.
Yeah,
he passed on that.
now, Richard, we're and I am so enjoying this conversation. I really am. Okay, but I've only got about 3 or 4 more minutes, and then we're going to wrap up. Okay, that doesn't mean you can't come back, because we can have you back for some more conversation at another show. But I do want to get into you yourself. Let me toss this out there, and then you take it from there. You and your brother, I believe, went to college. You graduated, but your brother did not, because both of you enlisted. I want to hear about you. You flew in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. You were on a B-52 bomber,
yeah.
Correct?
Mm-hmm.
What was it that you did? You flew 59 missions, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, when I was going to college, you know, had a draft. They gave us a number of what your draft number was, and how when you would be selected to having to go into the military. So when I was in college, I said, well, you know, we hadn't had a war. This was 1963. I had to make a decision. We hadn't had a war in 10 or 12 years. I said, I can just join the military, go in as an officer, and, you know, spend my time and get out. Get it over with.
Okay. All right.
And we had my junior year, we had to go to a summer camp to go into advanced ROTC. So we have spent 2 years, and then come out of a college as an officer, second lieutenant. So we had to go to summer camp in 63. And again, I was saying that, yeah, we hadn't had a war in a while. I'll just join up and get it done. Well, as soon as we got to camp, I was carrying my suitcase to our barracks. It was a 1 month camp we had to go to. And then someone says, hey, did you hear about that? Our ship being attacked in the Battle of Tonkin in Vietnam. I said, oh my God.
What have I done?
So I graduated just in time for the Vietnam War.
Okay.
So, I needed money, so they said, well, you know, if you go into flight school, you can get $100 a month extra for flying. I said, okay, I'll take that. So went into school, and they signed me to fly B-52s. Wow. I didn't know what a B-52 was when I got in, but it would take...
And what did you do on that B-52?
I was a navigator.
Okay.
So he's the one... The navigator was take you to the, we would go to the bomb, the initial point for a bombing attack, to go to the initial point.
Okay.
Take us to the target and when to drop the bomb and push the button.
Get you back.
All right.
And that's when I tell everybody back then, you know, that the Russia was supplying the surface-to-air missiles to the Vietnamese at that time, you know. So they were shooting B-52s down like they were flies on a wall back then. So I tell everybody I was being shot at by Russia, China, North Vietnam, South Vietnam, and Jane Fonda.
Okay, now there's there right there is our next podcast with Richard. Jane Fonda, that's all you had to say. I got to say, we've got to bring this to an end and close this thing out. But I've got to say, Randy, I have never felt so bad about closing a podcast because I'm having so much fun, if that's, and that's probably an improper word, but I'm so intrigued, Richard. I really sincerely want you to come back and we'll talk some more about this because I've just, if no one else has enjoyed this podcast, I certainly,
he's got some more,
I certainly
I'm sure he's got some more stories.
So you be thinking about them. We're going to have you back. But folks, here's what I'm going to leave you with. Never, ever take your freedom and your liberty for granted. Because freedom, it isn't free. Men like Richard Yotta has paid the price so that you and I can breathe in that freedom and liberty. Richard, thank you for coming back.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, man.
Happy New Year, everybody.